This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. Casper Henderson is a journalist and a writer who has worked for the Financial Times, The Independent and The New Scientist. From 2002 to 2005, he was a senior editor at Open Democracy. He received the Roger Deakin Award from the Society of Authors in 2009 and the Royal Society of Literature Gerwood Award in 2010. Casper Henderson is the author of The Book of Barely Imagined Beings, a 21st Century Bestiary. Casper, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
So, yeah, we're going to be talking about this incredible, beautiful book, The Book of Barely Imagined Beings. And before we actually get into the actual meat of the book, let's talk about what it is, I guess. Let's talk about its influences, because it's subtitled The 21st Century Bestiary, but you also talk about it being influenced by another book, a particular book by Borges, The Book of Imaginary Beings. So perhaps we should talk about that one first of all.
Sure. The book you've mentioned is by the Argentine writer Borges, or Borges is more or less how they pronounce it in Spanish. And he was a mid-20th century author who was hugely influential on a number of writers over really two or three generations up till today. One of his books is called The Book of Imaginary Beings. And to summarise it, which is difficult, it's a collection of myths and stories about imaginary creatures that, for whatever reason, fascinated Borges. And he created this book in the 50s. And it just gives you some flavour of the directions and strange places to which human imagination can go.
So we're talking about not just mythical beings, but beings from literature. And
that's right. It's a compendium, really, very idiosyncratic. All kinds of creatures in here. There's a creature imagined by C.S. Lewis. There are fairies, fauna of Chile, fauna of China, fauna from US folklore, the golem, strange creatures from the Bible, all kinds of things, really. I mean, the list is, I think there's over 100 different imaginary creatures in here, from myths and biblical stories and folklore from virtually every culture in the world.
He describes it himself in the introduction as being not a book to read from the beginning to the end, but one to sort of dip into.
Yeah, it's kind of like a kaleidoscope. It's every time you open the book, in my experience, you find something a little bit different. When you've read one thing, it informs something else that you read. So it has something of the feel of an infinite book, which is another of the tropes of Borges. You probably know, many of your listeners will be familiar with one of his most famous stories, The Library of Babel, or The Library of Babel, which envisages not an infinite library, but a library that's indefinitely large and much larger than the known universe, or probably even than most conceptions of the multiverse.
Moving back in time a little bit, you also talk about something called the German name is fantastic, so the Wunderkammern.
Wunderkammer or Wunderkammer, it might be the plural, it means a wonder chamber in German. And they're probably people, if they search their imaginations or their memories, they'll have seen pictures of these. They were created largely in the Renaissance, like 15th, but particularly the 16th century. And they are what they sound. They were rooms or large cabinets filled with strange things that people had brought back from all different places. And because we're talking about a time before systematic modern science as we know it, which developed arguably 17th, 18th, and certainly in the 19th century, you might have fossils next to a supposed mummified body of a mermaid, or a strange pufferfish next to the bones of a troglodyte man. You know, these extraordinary things, people didn't know what they were, but they were just, they're the precursors of museums in a sense, and they're also the precursors of systematic study of the natural world as we think of it today.
So the medieval bestiary there, how does that differ? So what are we talking about there?
Well, that's going another step back in European history. The medieval bestiaries or bestiaries are kind of does what it says on the tin. They're books of beasts, they're books of animals, and they have their origin in collections of writings which we know of from late classical antiquity, from Alexandria, which of course was a Greek city in late classical times. And these documents combined biblical stories, some Greek science and other materials into descriptions of various animals, which these descriptions then fed through to the European medieval period, where they were incorporated in great, beautiful, illuminated manuscripts. Illuminated in this sense, not meaning they've got a light shone on them, but meaning that they're illustrated with very richly coloured drawings, extraordinarily beautiful paintings, essentially, using gold and all kinds of wonderful mineral colours to make astonishing pictures. So bestiaries or bestiaries reached their pinnacle as an art form in roughly the 1300s, particularly in France and England. And they combined this ancient knowledge with, as I mentioned, biblical stories, and they tried to tell their readers how the world is according to the medieval mind, how each animal, for example, is a lesson in God's plan, because of course everything to the medieval mind is an allegory of God's creation.
This was going to be my next question. For want of a better way of phrasing it, what is the point of these things? Because, as you mentioned, they are a mixture of mythical beasts, biblical beasts, but also real beasts. So they're not strictly a first stab at science as such, and they're also not strictly a allegorical thing. They're a sort of a mixture of the two things.
They are. I mean, I'm no scholar of this, but as far as I understand, if you talk to somebody around 1300, they wouldn't have these categories as we think of them today, of science as against myth, or as we would describe it. And the point of these books, which I think was your question, is they would have several uses. They would be entertainment, certainly, if you look at them, and they're still entertaining and extraordinary. But I think they were also used as methods of instructions, and one can see things that come out of them later, such as emblem books, which are very specifically designed to instruct people and how to behave, you know, how to behave virtuously or selflessly or whatever it might be. And bestiaries would probably have been used, among other things, to educate priests, trainee priests. Of course, you know, that's what universities were about. They were for the creation of, or, you know, the training of people to take holy orders so that they could pray for your soul and make sure you didn't go down to the other place.
So what then is the Book of Barely Imagined Beings?
Well, it's a very strange hybrid or chimera of all these things. I mean, I guess the point is that I wanted to bring something together that, for me at least, said something about the times in which we live. And for me, that includes the fact that we do live, we're the children of the scientific revolution, of the Enlightenment, so of Hume and Darwin. We have our science, but we are inevitably, as humans, we're creatures who create value and seek meaning. And these things, in my view, will not be solely determined by our scientific discoveries. They're also determined by our social nature, by our traditions, our customs, our laws and our history. And also, I think, as any scientist who's really worth up to scratch will tell you, we have to be quite humble about the limits of our knowledge. So we need to recognise that we don't know how things are fully, and we may be indefinitely far in the future that we ever do. So we still live in a time when we live by myths, essentially. We have governing myths. I mean, one that, say, some people might criticise or praise is what they would call the myth of progress, that, you know, every day in every way humans are working it out and we're going to build better societies. To some people, they would see that as a myth. Others would see it as a truth. But I think we need to be cautious about what we decide is a given truth. And the books try to partly address that. It's also, going back to Borges, my starting point was that the real world is more extraordinary and more astonishing than many of the things, perhaps almost everything, that humans have ever dreamt up in their own imaginations. And this, for me, is a very important point. It's an aesthetic point because it's about beauty and what kind of can motivate our lives. But it's also, it's a moral and political point, I think, because if we ground ourselves in awareness of what's really there, my hope is that it can make us better people and help us build a better future, actually. So there's something in that.
I think one of the key threads that runs through the book is the centrality of evolution to this. There's a fantastic quote, who you'll have to remind me who it actually was who said it: nothing makes sense except in light of evolution.
Theodor Dobzhansky, I think it is, whose name I have probably mispronounced now. Yes, I mean, this is, I'm not saying, it might have sounded from what I said just now, that evolution is a myth. You know, evolutionary biology and the context within which it sits is grounded in very careful assessment of evidence. And I'm not saying that's mythical. What I'm saying is that we can interpret it in ways that can take us in a number of directions. And some of those directions can be misleading. Now, one highly contested area we might come on to is evolutionary psychology. You know, how much do we say we're just stone ages in a fast lane, and if men rape, then that's just because of the evolutionary inheritance? I mean, that's to caricature, but, you know, people do go a little bit astray when they try to apply, on occasions, at least this is my view, they try to apply science to society in perhaps inappropriate ways. But yes, evolution, because evolution is a stunning central fact of life, and it's endlessly beautiful, to misquote Darwin, and endlessly astonishing.
So the way the book's laid out is there's a set of essays in an A to Z format, although there are 27 rather than 26. There are various themes that are carried on throughout the book. But I want to ask you, before we actually go on to look at some of the specific chapters, a really quite prosaic question. How did you choose? How did you choose those 27 out of all of the, you know, the millions of wonderful species in the world?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've been asked that a number of times. And there was a certain amount of arbitrariness there. I had to put a limit on what I was doing. I wanted to cover a lot of ground, and in addition to evolution, there are themes in the book around time and memory and human imagination, and most specifically something we will perhaps discuss later, which is the Anthropocene and the extinction that's going on around us and the human relationship to nature in the future. I wanted to get in all these themes, and I wanted to give it a structure which would just help the reader to dip in various places or to read it from beginning to end if they wanted. You can do both. And an A to Z is a very simple structure to use. In fact, it's not something you find in medieval bestiaries. It does happen to be how Borges' Book of Imaginary Beings is structured as an A to Z. But I had to, you know, you have to draw a limit on what you're doing somewhere. And I actually wrote about three or four times as much as there is in the book. But I wanted to limit it to essay-length chapters, which are digressive and hopefully thoughtful, but are identifiable and memorable because they relate to usually one specific amazing animal. And these amazing animals might be ones we think we know, or they're, in many cases, I think, animals that are much less familiar for many people.
We'll start looking at some of the examples then, and I think, yeah, the theme that's going to come up as we do this is very specifically, I think, the continual tension in the relationship between human beings and animals. And the first example, we'll start right at A, and it's a very good example of that. This is the axolotl. So, first of all, I'll just ask you simply to tell us what it is.
Right, well, an axolotl is, broadly speaking, it's a kind of salamander, so it's an amphibian, and it's a Mexican salamander, and it's, I think, it was roughly a bit bigger than your hand in length, a bit longer than your hand, stretched little finger to thumb. And it has extraordinary, it has a kind of pinkish skin, a bit like a northern European who hasn't had much sun. And it has extraordinary external gills. They look like branching feathers on the sides of its head.
And a lovely smile.
And a lovely little smile, yeah, very cute. Or a little disturbing, perhaps, yeah.
So before we look at the axolotl and, you know, the specific things that are of interest of that actual, you know, branch of the salamander family, let's look more closely at that family. You use this chapter as a jumping-off point to look at the way that people have sort of seen our relationship to animals going right back to antiquity, really. You raise Aristotle's history of animals and Pliny's history, which are like the sort of examples of the first time where we've actually set out to try and look at things in a more scientific way. And one of the interesting things that comes out of that is this idea that once things are said in those books, in the same way that with like Galen in medicine, you know, once something is set in one of those books, people believe it and don't see any reason to question it. And the thing that I'm trying to get to here is everybody believed that salamanders lived in fire and were basically impervious to fire, which seems like an obvious thing to be able to test, frankly. A bit cruel, but a really easy and obvious thing to be able to test. Where did this idea come from?
This is one of the themes of the chapter, and you're right. I find it fascinating, and it's true that once ideas get stuck, and I think this, by the way, I think this still applies to us today, but it may be that this goes back to the Zoroastrians, although it's not clear. If you look etymologically at the word, there's some indication that salamander mm-hmm. comes from the ancient Persian words for fire within. You know, we might be cautious about that etymology because, of course, people have got into all kinds of trouble on assuming things about etymologies. But that you're right that both Aristotle and Pliny make reference to this supposed property of salamanders. And one of the things you can say about both, well, particularly Aristotle, is he was actually a remarkable true scientist, as we would say today. But in some senses, he did not much empirical research. I think the first time that, at least the first time I uncovered in doing the research for the book, that there's a record of somebody testing this is Thomas Brown, the 17th century English physician, who wrote a book called Pseudodoxia Epidemica, which roughly means the bad science. It's like the bad science in 1642. And, you know, it looks like he tossed one in the flames and it obviously, poor thing, shriveled up. But there are early accounts. There's this this outrageous, what's the word, kind of rapscallion villain, Benvenuto Cellini. He was an artist, but he was also a rapist and a murderer, an Italian, larger-than-life figure. He records in his autobiography a memory of his father showing him little salamander in the flames in the house where they were when he was a child, and hitting him over the head to make sure that he remembered this extraordinary moment. Probably what was happening there is that somebody brought the firewood in, you know, perhaps in the Italian hills, you know, damp firewood, or slightly damper, or at least a place where salamanders might have been, you know, trying to basically nest or stay undercover. That had been brought into the house and thrown on the flames, and people saw the salamander in the flame, and they probably saw it before it was actually burning. They probably saw it running around.
Let's look a bit more closely at the axolotl then. It has a couple of really interesting characteristics. The first one of which is, there's this concept of neoteny, which you can tell us what that means, first of all. It's a very interesting thing, and there's not many examples in the natural world.
Well, there may be more examples than we can think, but neoteny and the adjective neotenic describe a condition where you've got an animal that in its adult form resembles the juvenile form of its forebears, of its ancestors. And in fact, some people think there's strong evidence that humans are quite neotenic. We do quite strongly resemble juvenile apes of other great ape species. We look much more like a baby gorilla than we do like an adult gorilla. So in the evolutionary processes, and this is actually quite well documented in across a number of species, there might have been selective advantage in an animal, an organism, coming to sexual fertility and reproductive potential while it's still in a fairly juvenile stage. You know, so you can see this perhaps in fish and in all kinds of animals. And this might have happened quite a bit. But of course, it also has there's a kind of allegorical feel to this, you know, the childlike animals and childlike humans, and that's part of the theme of this chapter.
So then the idea that the axolotl is, you know, somehow a juvenile adult, if that's the correct way to describe it, does that then link with the other interesting property, which we'll talk about now, which is why it's being researched for use in, you know, for medical research? Because basically, if you chop a leg off an axolotl, it will regenerate a new leg, and it will do this repeatedly. So in stem cell research, it's being used as a way of perhaps the possibility in the future that humans might be able to grow their leg back if they chop their leg off.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know if specifically axolotls have been, to what degree they've been used in stem cell research. And one of the things that becomes crashingly obvious to me, which wasn't before, maybe it's obvious to you, is just how quickly the science is moving. So, for example, in stem cell technology, people have moved on enormously in the 3 or 4 years I've been working on this book. But axolotls have been very useful in scientific research because people working in regenerative medicine, because they have, as you say, this extraordinary quality to be able to regenerate a whole limb or just part of a limb if it's cut off, like a digit or a tail, even apparently some internal organs, and to do this without scarring. And, you know, very differently, if we are unfortunate enough to lose a limb, we might heal over if we get the right kind of attention, but we're never going to regrow a limb. Whereas axolotls and some other salamanders, some other amphibians can do this. I don't know if this property is specifically related to neoteny in axolotls, but it happens that axolotls, one of the ways that they're likely to survive, because the species is critically endangered in its natural habitat, which now happens to Mexico City, basically, one of the reasons they're surviving is because they're so easy to breed and so useful for scientific research. So they're, in a sense, they become, this is, you could say it's a little bit symbolic of how animals, how they thrive in the world. It's in this case because we're protecting them because we want to use them for research.
Well, but also because, more crudely, because they're so cute. Because there's obviously a huge trade in axolotls as pets. As you said, they're easy to breed and to keep for pet owners.
Yeah, no, apparently they are quite a big popular item with pet owners. I haven't been into a house and seen one floating around in a tank.
No, I never have.
No, apparently they are. There's a fair number of them around. You know, you may be surprised any day. If I had one, I think I'd put a huge magnifying plate of glass on the front window so its face looked huge and people would be really freaked out when they saw it. But they are cute looking. They're the funny looking, as I said, you mentioned at the top, they have this funny smile and they float oddly in the water, and you know, they might remind you of some friends. There's a very strange and disturbing story by, and as it happens, another Argentine writer, Julio Cortázar, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, on a man who stares at an axolotl through the window of a tank and undergoes a very strange transformation.
I want to bring in the next chapter that we're going to look at, because I think there's ways in which these two are linked. And we're going to go all the way to H. And as we've been talking about, one of the major themes of this book is the way that human beings interact with nature. It's no surprise that you've chosen humans as one of the barely imagined beings. And I want to perhaps, on more sort of general terms, look at the idea of how long we've been, I guess, how long have human beings been sort of examining their relationship with the natural world. It's obvious to say that human beings are part of the natural world, but also we're inevitably separate from it slightly as well, or at least that's how we see ourselves.
Well, that's a really interesting kind of deep question, to which I don't know if I have an either interesting or deep answer. But I think there might be a couple of things to distinguish here. One is how we do imagine our place in the world, however we describe it. But also this point about the natural world as opposed to the human world, which arguably I think is quite a recent idea. Mm-hmm. It's perhaps around 500 years old or about even less. That we've started to make this distinction. So, for example, back in the medieval period, they wouldn't have made that distinction. They didn't think of the natural world as anything distinct from God's plan, which was readily comprehensible, if you know, at least to God, and of which we were part. They didn't see, as we famously learn, as most of us in this country as kids, in the Bible story, the animals are created and man is given dominion over them. You know, they didn't see nature as something separate. Of course, the man was fallen in nature, so it did have a different status. But nature as we see it today, and the separation from nature that we're used to thinking of, is product of the scientific revolution and the industrial revolution, of course, you know, when we become a highly urbanized species. But how long humans have been thinking about and interacting with animals, you know, ever since before we were human. And, of course, the genus Homo has been around approximately 2 million years. Precursors, very human-like precursors, 4 to 6 million perhaps. But genus Homo goes back about 2 million years and has been evolving in fits and starts until we became roughly modern, perhaps 150, 200,000 years ago.
Well, the reason I raised that question is because one of the things you look at in the book, there's a fantastic picture of the incredible cave painting in
Chauvet
in France, which are just paintings of lions on a rock wall, and they look like they were painted yesterday. You know, they're so incredibly painted. And I've been to Altamira in Spain and seen the similar things. It's incredibly striking how it's only when you're actually there and you see those things in 3D that you realise that they use the shape of the rock to depict the things as well, and they're so incredibly advanced. And yet they're, as you mentioned in the book, there isn't necessarily pictures of human beings, pictures of plants, pictures of landscapes. It seems to be that the relationship with animals was the important thing.
Well, it may be. I mean, we have to remember we only got very few. It's likely, at least, although we don't know this either, but it seems very likely that only a few of the cave paintings that were created have survived, given mm-hmm. how extraordinarily specific the conditions have to be for sure. them to survive. So there could be all kinds of stuff we just don't know.
All the landscape caves might have gone.
Yeah, exactly. All the ones with like obscene graffiti might have been somewhere else. Yeah. But no, it's an extraordinary fact that the caves that we know of, all of them so far, I think this is true, have very largely animal representation, and some of it extraordinarily beautiful. You mentioned Altamira, Chauvet, the best known for many years, because Chauvet was only discovered quite recently, and was the Lascaux Caves, mm-hmm. also in southern France. And Picasso famously said, "We have learned nothing. You know, the art here is as great as anything we're doing today." Of course, all those cave paintings are, give or take, let's say between 15 and 25,000 years old. So they're, in the terms of the evolution of the species, they're quite recent, given that anatomically modern humans have probably been around for pushing 200,000 years. So it's, you know, we're talking about a tenth or a bit more than a tenth of that time that we have paintings from. There's evidence of artistic activity. It's contested, but there's some evidence that might of surviving fragments going back, I think. There's these ochre, these patterns made with ochre, kind of red dye, I think found in South Africa, which go back a lot further, and I'm hesitating on the date, but I think it might be as much as 70,000 years. So we don't know. These are tiny fragments of evidence we've got, and there's some of the clues, maybe some of the most important clues we don't know about the nature of how people thought at that time. But we can, and this is something that's partly explored in this chapter, among other things, is we can make, and archaeologists and paleontologists do make, some reasonable suppositions based on evidence and various other things they can put together, that behavioural modernity, as it's called, so the kinds of languages that we talk today as a species, and many of the kinds of behaviours have been well characterised for well over 100,000 years. And, of course, they will have developed, those behaviours will have developed from much earlier behaviours, which would have a much longer history. And we can look at earlier species in our genus. We've heard of Neanderthals, but going back further than that to Homo erectus, was around for best part of a billion years, Heidelbergensis, which was perhaps our more immediate precursor. They had some very sophisticated behaviours. They were hunting with spears, for example, in the case of Heidelbergensis. They clearly had, the evidence suggests very strongly that they had sophisticated means of communication. And there's a lot of debate, I partly touched on in this chapter, about what was the nature of their communication mm-hmm. system. Was it a musy language? Was there, you know, were music and language at one point joined in some way, or rather indistinguishable, and they've taken separate paths? So those people lived there lives, you know, in contact with nature, that it's very hard for us to comprehend today. You know, we might see the occasional Attenborough film or the Human Planet, or maybe, I don't know, Neil, if you spent time with indigenous peoples or, you know, the San people in the Kalahari. The closest to nature means they, if they were speaking, they would have told stories and they would have had interactions which were very intimate. Their sense of themselves in nature was very different from ours.
I've not been able to get the image out of my head now of somewhere in the world there is a cave version of the National Portrait Gallery that we're going to find one day with all of these cavemen with spears.
Maybe. Yeah, who knows?
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. I'm talking to Caspar Henderson about the book of Barely Imagined Beings. So, Caspar, the next chapter of the book I want to look at is there's one other primate apart from humans that you've chosen among your 27, and this is the Japanese macaque. Why is this the one?
There's a few reasons. One of them is it's just the funniest looking and extraordinary monkey. There are so many amazing monkeys and bizarre monkeys, but it's perhaps very famous for enjoying a nice hot bath in these Japanese mountain springs, sitting there in the hot water and looking blissed out while outside it's freezing cold. They're funny looking, as I mentioned. I mean, they have these very narrow set eyes, remind me a little bit of George W. Bush. I think they're the northerlymost primate apart from humans. They, you know, they're very resourceful. They've managed to survive through the Japanese winter. Only a few of them, by the way, get to hang out in the springs, because they've got a very hierarchical, very, in some respects, to use a very loaded term, very cruel society. They have, you know, there's a lot of in-group violence and assertion of right and hierarchy. And, you know, this is in many ways is quite reminiscent of humans, or at least how humans are often characterized. So another reason I chose this animal is because there's a book by an Italian primatologist called Maestro Pieri about the Machiavellian politics of rhesus macaques. Mm-hmm. That's actually a related, a different species, but another kind of macaque, which is very widely spread across Asia. And it's hard to know how much of this is tongue-in-cheek, but he describes what he calls the Machiavellian politics of rhesus macaques. The term actually comes from Franz de Waal, but this very ruthless, power-hungry, power-driven model of behaviour. And many people see in this like an analogy for human history. It's a very grim model, but there's, you know, that you can quite easily bring together the evidence. And one of the things I've tried to do in this chapter is look at some of that evidence and the ways in which it's been used and maybe abused, including in the case of going back to Machiavelli, the famous Italian, we'd now call him a political theorist, I suppose, of the 15th century, whose most famous notorious book, The Prince, is just the manual of evil power grabbers everywhere. But in the case of Machiavelli, actually some of his other writings, maybe the ones that expressed his own views rather than being perhaps satirical, were those that recommended a republican form of government that was that allowed people to talk and to negotiate non-violently rather than through ruthless exploitation and threat of death.
We're talking about the ways in which human beings and nature interact, and the macaque, the rhesus macaque that you're talking about at the moment particularly, it's an animal that's used extensively in research, isn't it? I mean, there's the number of rhesus macaques that have given their life to advance medical science must be quite phenomenal.
Yes, I think it is. You know, that's a very contested area, of course. I don't know if we want to go into it, but I think I would say that a lot has been discovered as a result, and you know, those results are being applied in many areas of medicine and elsewhere today. But one of the things I touched on in the chapter is perhaps some of the most horrifying experiments ever performed on intelligent animals, mm-hmm. done in the 1960s with rhesus macaques, specifically. They were trying to achieve what the psychologists called, we're trying to achieve psychopathology. How can we make this animal completely psychopathic? And they found the only way they could do this was to deprive them of the contact with their mothers, this, you know, to erase them from birth in complete isolation. You know, we are, just like rhesus macaques, we're profoundly social animals. We can only really thrive in social relation. And the only way to break that is to completely sunder that bond, it seems. And this was one of the things they worked on. I'm sure they believed the best intentions. They would, you know, they believed this would deliver useful results. But in that case, very disturbing research.
I raise that more because I've just recently finished David Quammen's Spillover, which is a book about pandemics, which is for a later interview. And just to even the balance there, the Rhesus Macaque played a very heroic role in the discovery of the polio virus, for instance.
But right, good point. Thank you.
Yeah, but I want to talk about another crazy experiment for a bit. And actually, you know, this is the bad experiment. It might not necessarily have been so bad for the apes involved. You talk about a Soviet experiment to breed humans and chimpanzees briefly. Mm-hmm. What happened there?
Yeah, this is an extraordinary thing. I describe it as being like something out of Mikhail Bulgakov, you know, mm-hmm. the famous author of Famous Four, his great, great book, The Master and Margarita. In the early 20s, the Soviets wanting to prove, you know, they were... Marx was a big fan of Darwin, and the Soviets, who, you know, believed they were inheriting Marx's mantle, of course, arguably grotesquely debasing Marx's thinking. But nevertheless, they saw themselves as the inheritors of Marx and also of Darwin, and they wanted to prove that humans were continuous with the rest of creation, with nature, as they would say. And one of the things they wanted to see, to what extent we were related, how closely we were related, to the extent could humans breed with chimpanzees. So a couple of I don't know if I need to fill in the dots, but they tried it both ways in Africa and in Cuba in a private zoo, with, it has to be said, zero success.
Mm-hmm. So moving on swiftly from that, then, I'd like to talk about iridogorgia.
Yeah, iridogorgia, yes.
And again, this is one where I'm just going to have to ask you to explain what it is.
Yes, this really is something you have to see to believe. It looks something like a large corkscrew with fronds coming off it, if you can imagine that, almost like bicycle spokes, in a sense, coming from this twisting central spine. It's a cnidarian, and the cnidaria include gorgonians. That might all be a bit befuddling. It's very distantly related to coral, mm-hmm. But it's in that phylum. And corals and jellyfish are also cnidaria. In the case of Rhodogorgia, this gorgonian, it lives very deep down on the seabed. It's iridescent. This is partly where its name comes. It means, I guess, it comes from iridescent mm-hmm. gorgonian, probably. It's actually first, I think, I don't know if it was first discovered, but the first evidence I report in the book is one of these great oceanographic trials in the 19th century. The Challenger expedition mm-hmm. brought it up from the deep sea. And it fascinates me because it looks like it's from another planet. You just can't believe the thing. But it's... The chapter explores something around beauty and symmetry.
Yeah, this is what I want to get us onto, and it sort of links into the chapter that we're going to discuss next as well, which will be the Nautilus. You use this as a leaping-off point to talk about... Well, I guess there's a starting point with Robert Hooke's amazing book of 1665, Micrographia, which has these incredible detailed drawings of, you know, flies blown up via a microscope and things. And as you said, an exploration of geometry in nature. And you describe the Iridogorgia as reminding you of DNA, of the double helix as well.
Yes, as I mentioned, the Iridogorgia has this central helical spiral. It's quite a regular helix. And, you know, perhaps the connection is a little bit tendentious. But one of the great icons of 20th century science is the double helix of DNA. It's like up there with E equals MC squared as, like, you know, that's science and the beauty of science, because it finds this symmetry and beauty at the heart of reality, and that's like, wow, man, that's, you know. So it is remarkable. One of the things the chapter goes into a little bit is getting beyond that stage of wow to let's look at some of the deeper beauty and complexity behind these symmetrical forms. But it's also the chapter is a bit of a celebration of the symmetrical forms we find in nature, all the way down, by the way. So going down to viruses, mm-hmm. this is something we've not even touched on yet, but how cells and viruses have these extraordinary, mind-blowingly complex processes, but also some very beautiful symmetries in them.
Well, the one I wanted to talk about, I wasn't going to go all the way down to viruses, but you talk about something called radiolaria, mm. which is a plankton, a single-cell plankton, and the variety of... They're like, for want of a better example, snowflake. The range of examples of shapes and varieties is absolutely stunning.
Yes, that's right. I mean, radiolaria, they're protists, I believe. They're the single-celled planktonic organisms. They're very, very ancient, probably Precambrian. But they've evolved into... shapes, there's so many, and mm-hmm. it's easy to find these online once you start to look. In the late 19th century, Ernst Haeckel, who was Darwin's, I think, first at least, but certainly his most famous champion in Germany in the late 19th century, was also a very able illustrator, and one of his early projects was a book of pictures of radiolaria, these extraordinary forms. Radiolaria comes from the Latin meaning radiating form, I think. So some of them look a bit like, a Sputnik with mm-hmm. things coming off, but others take forms like lampshades or kind of sword shapes or if you think of the entrances to the Paris Metro, some of those wrought iron shapes were partly deliberately and consciously modelled on these extraordinary natural forms that Haeckel and others had drawn. Yeah, it was a kind of endless inventiveness in nature. The great variety of nature at play is the phrase from Pliny, actually. You know, that where there's space and evolutionary time and an evolutionary space, then organisms can take on a range of barely imagined forms, barely imagined extraordinary and beautiful shapes.
So one of the chapters a little further on then is the Nautilus. The Nautilus having this extraordinary spiral shell. So let's talk a little bit about the spiral. We've talked a little bit about geometry, but let's talk about the spiral in nature. Why is there so many examples of this, I guess?
Oh my goodness, well, you'd have to ask somebody much wiser and more mathematically literate than me, but I mean, nautiluses are very well known for their spiral shapes. It's, you know, people collect them. It is a logarithmic spiral, but it's not a golden section spiral, but it's a beautiful, beautiful shape. And it does happen that this is something that it comes from the mathematics when you get growth based on proportion to an existing entity, to put it kind of very crudely and probably a little bit wrongly. But this is one of the things that arises. But you also see this in non-living systems. You see spirals in the movement of ocean waters, obviously in the atmosphere. You know, we can see them in hurricanes, most famously, or in vegetables. You know, there's this, is it Romanesco, that kind of broccoli? It's extraordinary. I mean,
it looks like a fractal.
Well, it is also like a fractal, but it has spiral shapes in it, you know. And so you do see this across nature, and there's something that which people have been, you know, Newgrange in Ireland, there are spirals on the stones there. I think that's more or less contemporary with Stonehenge. Clearly people have been fascinated by spirals a long time.
You use this chapter as a jumping off point for a couple of fantastic digressions, one of which, not necessarily surprisingly by the title, is a history of submarines. But the one I want to talk about is, let's talk a little bit about what's interesting about the eye of the Nautilus.
Yeah, Nautiluses have been around an incredibly long time. They didn't look exactly like they do now. Many of them might have had much longer shells rather than the spiral shape. But they've been around for something like 400 million years. And they have this very simple eye. It's a pinhole eye, essentially. They don't have a lens and a cornea as you and I do. They've got literally this gap and with no protection over it. And it's quite a crude eye, but it's good enough for a nautilus, and it's enabled them to go about their business, basically going up and down in the water column in day and night. And it's, you know, the first cameras, obviously, first human mechanical visual devices were pinhole cameras. They go back, some suggestion that Aristotle and some ancient Chinese scholars had pinhole cameras, and of course they were popular in the Renaissance and beyond. And the first photograph actually was probably taken with a pinhole camera in about 1826, of like 8-hour exposure to get a very crude image. That part of the chapter is about the history of the mechanical eye and its relation to human vision and how it changes how we conceive the world. It's actually something, there's another chapter earlier in the book, Gonodactylus, about eyes in nature and eyes in animals.
But that's the jumping spider.
No, it? Gonodactylus is the
that has terrifying eyes.
It does, yeah. No, the Gonodactylus is the genital fingered stomatopod.
Oh,
of course, you know.
Of course. You reproduce a photograph of the, I think it's the earliest surviving example of a pinhole photograph, but also more interestingly, I find the one of the earliest example of a photograph that has a person in it. Obviously, there was early photography; you had to stay still. You know, those portraits of people standing very sort of stock still for 10 minutes while it was exposed. But there's a photograph of a Paris street scene which captures somebody who's like
a shoeshine
person. Yeah. Which is, and there's something. I was just struck by the sort of incredible power of that thing, that this is maybe the first example of a person caught on film. And as you say, that how does that then sort of change the way that we relate to the world? It obviously had like a massive impact on painting, for instance. You know, it changed. That's where impressionism and everything sort of comes out of, changing the relationship that we have with the painted image. But then how did photography then change the way that we saw the world?
Well, I think there's lots of ways in which it did, and I've tried to explore that a bit in the chapter. And I think one of them is it has changed our relationship with time. So you mentioned this picture. It's I think it's called the Boulevard du Temple. Mm-hmm. That's the name of the street in Paris. The picture's by Louis Daguerre, who's, you know, we've heard
daguerreotype.
Of daguerreotypes. Yeah, we've all heard of those. So he was a pioneer of photography in the 1840s. And, yeah, you've got, basically, he stuck this camera out of his atelier window to get the street, quite a view along the street, quite a long way you can see. And because I think the exposure time was something like 8 or 10 minutes, people walking on the streets just disappeared, just like ghosts, essentially, which, after all, in the long run, is all we are. But it happens that this man was standing with his foot on a stool and a shoeshine boy and was probably there for 7, 8, 10 minutes. And so there's this fairly, in the corner of the picture, at one corner of the street, there's a barely discernible image of a standing man, and you can make out it's somebody at their foot shining the shoe. Photography makes it possible for us, in some sense, to take things out of time, or at least give us the impression that we're doing that. And that, I think, has had a huge impact on how we see our own lives. I mean, the most precious things for many people are the photographs they have from their lives, from their past. And it's been part of renegotiation of our sense of reality and nature, which feeds right through to what's happening with mechanical images today.
Photography enabled a way for the masses to achieve some sort of immortality. Things have obviously, multiplied on and on and on, and now, people put their entire lives on the internet, in photographs, on Facebook and, Instagram and things. But there's something striking about the idea that suddenly there was a way for anybody to be captured. There's obviously that, the old canard about people thinking if you took a photograph it would capture their soul or something.
Hmm. I mean, it has, of course, over time. And that revolution began, I think, in the 1870s, 1880s, really. I think the Kodak box brownie is maybe late 1880s. That's the first mass photographic method affordable for, somebody with a lower middle class job or something, a clerical job or something like that. They could afford to take pictures, and that's the origin of our modern kind of image addicted society.
I raised the concept of some form of immortality as a cheap link to get us onto the next item. The next chapter I want to talk about is Quetzalcoatlus, which is the only creature that you choose that's actually extinct. Why did you decide to use an example of something that we don't have anymore?
There's at least two or possibly three reasons. I sound like the Spanish Inquisition. There are three... No, there was at least two or three reasons why I chose it. And one is that behind a lot of the writing in this book is the spectre of extinction. So I mentioned earlier on what some people call the Anthropocene extinction, this current perturbation of nature, which may be greater than the mass extinction that killed the dinosaurs. It might be as big as the Permian extinction 252 million years ago, resulting from human activity on the planet. So we've got this, this background question around extinction. And of course, we know that in the end, everything will become extinct. So that's one reason. And I wanted to have like a reminder at this roughly middle point in the book about that. But specifically Quetzalcoatlus, it's a pterosaur. So that means, as people know, a flying dinosaur, actually, just to be a bit anoraki about it. They weren't dinosaurs. They're related, they're reptiles, but they were not dinosaurs. And Quetzalcoatlus was probably the largest animal ever to have flown. Roughly speaking, it could grow as big as a Cessna aircraft or a Spitfire. I've mistaken in the book, according to the latest evidence, its weight was probably about twice what I've stated. It was probably over 200 kilos, so 400, 500 pounds in weight.
You talk in the book, one of the things that you discuss is the incredible idea that this thing ever got off the ground. So that's even more amazing.
Which is amazing, and there are people who've challenged that it could have done, but it looks very likely that it did. And astonishingly, in like the last decade or so, from new fossil discoveries, which they've been able to study in a level of detail using new imaging and various techniques, they can tell stuff about the nature of its brain, because there are a few cases of the cast of the bone over the brain, so you can tell something about how the brain was inside. And they were very, you go back to like the old movies, and there's this very crude idea of this massive kind of creaking, flying, like something out of an Ed Wood movie, this sort of creaking, flying, stiff-winged creature. They were probably extremely agile and supple in the air. It's like mind-blowing that anything as big as that could ever have flown a biological organism. The other theme of the chapter is very, from the beginning, is the human dream of flight.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing alive today that weighs as much as a human that can fly. I think the heaviest organism that can fly is something called the great bustard. And they're funny, really delightful looking, basically like a more or less like a giant partridge, essentially, something like that. More like perhaps a turkey, anyway, the bustard. And humans have always dreamed of flying, and of course we've achieved it with technology. But one thing that fascinates me is where we're most closely connected to the world around us, where we feel most strongly, is often where, I'll be careful about this, but where we're least mediated by technology. Mm-hmm. And I think there's still a dream of, we've all had this dream maybe just last night of flying in our own bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that dream is still in us. I mean, who knows? But it does seem to be there. And in the very long run, you know, one wonders about whether humans would ever fly. I mean, it sounds mad, right? But in their own bodies.
Staying with that, you know, the idea of that dream, you talk about a, I guess now a discredited theory, but the people did have the idea that at one time, and I think Richard Owen, the very early paleontologist, was one of the people that proposed this, an idea that humans are actually more closely related to flying creatures than we actually are.
Oh, there've been a few people who've suggested this, and there was some Australian character who suggested that primates and bats were very closely related. It looks like he probably wasn't right. I mean, I think our closest living relative, so to speak, that is almost able to fly, something called a colugo. It's kind of like a lemur, although I think it's not actually a lemur. And it looks a bit like a flying squirrel, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's a glider in the mm-hmm. sense of, which is a delayed fall. You know, it can go a long way before it goes down, but it can't flap up into the sky. But yeah, people have wanted this to be true, but it looks like it wasn't ever true. No primate has flown.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. I'm talking to Casper Henderson, who's the author of the book of Barely Imagined Beings, A 21st Century Bestiary. So the next category of animal I want to look at, Casper, is one that I think, of all of the examples that you use, human beings have had the most fraught relationship with and have probably had the biggest impact on. And the example you use is the right whale. I'm talking about whales and humans' relationships with them, but the right whale is the example you use. And, well, the first thing I want to talk about, I wasn't aware of this until I read the book, is the very prosaic way in which the right whale got its name.
Yeah, it's very instrumental. It was the right whale to kill. That's where the English term comes from. And they were quite common in the oceans in the North Atlantic till the 15th century or beyond. There are four species which have been termed right whales, not to get too technical about it, but there's a North Atlantic right whale, there's a North Pacific right whale, there's a southern right whale in the Southern Ocean, and also the bowhead whale used to be called a right whale as well. Humans come along, and the easiest populations to kill, we slaughter very rapidly with right whales. I think Europe, at least, the earliest records are the Basque whalers of northern Spain, as we would call it, in the 11th century or so. These whales they tended to swim quite close to shore, and they were slow moving. And when they were killed, they floated, so very ideal kind of targets, very rich in oil and meat. They were steadily eliminated. Then, as the Europeans expanded into the Atlantic in the middle of the last millennium now, increasingly the fishery went to the Grand Banks and to New England and elsewhere. But you've got a picture that builds up over 200-300 years of the steady elimination of huge populations of whales, in many cases more than 99% of the population. And basically, once we killed 99%, we turn around and say, okay, well, we better protect a few because we love them and they're wonderful.
Well, this is where I'm going with this, because I guess it's the least we owe them after all, but we can also use the whale as an example of human beings turning that round, and, you know, the conservation movement really comes out of, you know, saving the whale.
It's certainly one of the really important strands in what you might term the contemporary and modern conservation movement, as perhaps most famously is the recordings of Whale Song, which were actually done initially for the US military in the 1960s, I think, for the US Navy, who, you know, wanted to track Soviet subs. But in 1970, Gary McVeigh and Roger Payne brought out this album, which became one of the great selling albums of its time, Songs of the Humpback Whale. And, you know, that became the theme tune of the environmental movement around the time of the first Earth Day and the rest of it. And it was also the time when the first photographs of the Earth from space were taken, and the sense of this extraordinary beautiful. And McVeigh and Payne published a paper in Science with evidence that they said showed that this is real song. This is an intelligent animal with sophisticated song. We need to pay attention to that and be aware of it. This is an intelligence, a consciousness on the planet. You know, it gets a bit new agey, but it's very important stuff. And it had a huge impact, I think, and it has, certainly in Western countries, it deeply informs our current views of whales and cetaceans more generally.
Well, you raised the idea of this first being heard by recordings of Soviet subs. Obviously, there are ways in which we're still having a massive impact on whales, despite the fact that they're such icons in the conservation movement, and shipping is obviously one of those ways.
Yeah, the sound, as you know, carries very well in water. It goes much faster in water than it does in air. And one of the extraordinary things that I remember talking to Roger Payne about this and to some others is when you've got factors of pressure and temperature in the deep ocean, you've got basically channels where sound will travel enormous distances. And it looks like whales have used these to communicate, you know, maybe thousands of kilometres and maybe even tens of thousands, mm-hmm. but certainly thousands of kilometres. In the deep ocean. And since the invention of the internal combustion engine, or the steam engine and the internal combustion engine, boat noise from humans has completely changed the oral ecology of the oceans. It's now a very noisy place. And this is for whales, this has been something like having blinkers put on or blinders, you know, because they obviously use sound. It's enormously important to them, both for communication and also in some species for hunting. And their world has been closed down on them by ship noise.
Is there anything we can do about that? I mean, beyond stopping shipping, which obviously isn't going to happen, is there a way in which that damage can be lessened?
People say there's a lot that can be done. And among the things that are usually discussed are redesigning boat hulls so that they're less noisy in the water, not running ships at high speed, and you get much more efficient use of your oil if you're not rushing around, and you slow it down, you get less noise. Putting the ships on, keeping them to more well-defined sea lanes, so you've got larger areas which are off-limits most of the time for most ships. All these kind of things may help. It's not clear whether they would be enough, as it were, but they could help a lot, yeah.
So moving on from the enormous right whale to the tiny little water-going creature, this is the delightfully named water bear. Tardigrade is another name for it, which some of our listeners may have heard before. I can remember John Mitchinson of QI talking about the tardigrade in the Little Atoms interview. Tell us again what this is, what a water bear is.
Well, a water bear is, they're about the size of a full stop in a sentence, or maybe a bit smaller. It's distant cousin of the arthropods, so it's a distant cousin of insects, as are the velvet worms. And it's many things, but it looks, well, to a German biologist in the late 19th century studying them under a microscope, perhaps he had an over-enthusiastic imagination, but they do look a bit like a little teddy bear, if a teddy bear had like six or eight legs and funny little eyes. They're kind of cute. One of the things that's remarkable about them is that they can go into a dormant state where they can withstand unbelievable extremes of temperature and pressure. They're present, by the way, right the way across the planet, from very high altitudes to the deep ocean, and also in very prosaic places like in the gutters. Probably wouldn't be surprising if there's moss in your gutters. There might well be water bears in it. But they were taken. There's this experiment four or five years ago now. Tardigrades in space, just taking them up there and seeing what happened. And the amazing thing is they can survive cosmic rays and all kinds of extreme temperatures of heat and cold, and more or less come through all right. Come through alive and kicking, which is quite something.
And they basically they desiccate then, and then basically once the conditions are more favourable, they just literally reanimate.
Pretty much, they go into the state called a tun, T-U-N. A bit like one of those Japanese water flowers, this dry thing that if you put in a cup, it will expand again. I mean, it's a little bit like that. And in this state, they can survive these really extreme conditions, and they can be like that, and it could be very, very cold, approaching temperatures you'd find in outer space and quite hot as well. I'm not sure how hot, but not very hot, but quite hot. They can then reanimate. Yes, they come into contact with water and they can get going again.
You've just mentioned those space experiments. So let's talk about what the point of those experiments was. There's an idea that those experiments on the water bear can give us some sort of insight into how humans could cope with space travel and cosmic rays and things. Let's talk about what those experiments actually did.
In the case of the water bear, they exposed it to the rigours of orbital travel and, where you've got things like cosmic rays, which are very destructive to living cells. They also had, I think, some fungi and bacteria and various other things. I think the water bear is the only complex animal that's been up in outer space and survived, basically, in the rigors of outer space. By the way, if you do go into outer space, your eyeballs won't pop out of your head, and you probably have about, I think it's something like 90 seconds before you need to get back inside the airlock and get back to reality. But in terms of I don't know how much the water bear can really tell us about our own future as humans in space, if we have one. But it's certainly, you know, this is a theme. It might seem very 1960s, but it's probably a trope in, and maybe more than that, that's going to, I think, is likely to recur in this century in terms of exploration of the solar system at first. And, you know, my own view is it's overwhelmingly likely that most exploration will be done with robots, von Neumann machines, even perhaps in the longer run. But, you know, robots are just so much easier. But people talk about the importance for the human spirit of getting men on Mars or women on Mars. And that's something I've gone into a bit.
Well, one of the things that those robots and von Neumann machines going out to other galaxies and other planets will be looking for is life elsewhere in the universe. And one way that we've used to get insight into that is going to extreme places on Earth, one of which is deep-sea hydrothermal vents. And I want to talk about a couple of chapters together, really. There's a creature called a Xenophyophore and a Yeti crab, both of which are things. One lives in herds on the abyssal plains, and one lives around deep-sea smokers. Let's talk about what these two things are, first of all.
OK. Well, the Xenophyophore is a single-celled organism, or at least it's a protist, but it's a giant thing. It can be almost as big as your head. It looks a bit like a kind of a slimy, muddy cabbage. Not very appealing to many people, but I think they're very remarkable and even in a way quite beautiful. And they live, as you said, they kind of excrete a trail of mucus and slime, and they slide very slowly across what we call the abyssal plain. So very large areas of the ocean floor are kind of flat and featureless and silt. In fact, as you know, 7/10 of the planet's covered in water, and a lot of it is the abyssal plain. There's huge amounts of this. And this is one of the creatures that forages and lives there. And the Yeti crab, the first species of Yeti crab, there have been a couple more discoveries, but the first kind of Yeti crab, which is actually a kind of squat lobster, is...
Sounds like a pop song.
Yeah. they've got these funny, hairy-looking, hairy claws. They live on black smokers, and they were discovered in 2005, I think, down in the South Pacific. In this environment where you've got water coming out, superheated water from volcanic activity being forced out of the seabed because it's under pressure at very high temperature, I think something like 400 centigrade. And you've got all kinds of organisms close to, but not actually in, this superheated water. And the Yeti crab is one of them.
You mentioned this idea of the robots, the von Neumann machines, these sort of self-replicating robots going out to other planets. And you use this chapter as a jumping off point to have a look at a discussion of the Yeti crab chapter we're talking about here. The relationship between humans and machines, looking forward to, you know, to artificial intelligence and robots and things. So why did that come out of that chapter?
Well, these chapters, as you said, Neil, they run slightly together with the water bear, and we've got this theme of space exploration. And with the Yeti crab, you're also looking at an environment where perhaps, at least it was thought, now most scientists don't think this, but it might be where life originated. But to some extent, crustacea are almost mechanical-looking organisms. They've got these claws and these pivots and joints. And I've claimed in this chapter that we're currently, you know, it feels like sometimes that we're on the verge of a mechanical Cambrian explosion. So, you know, the Cambrian explosion is when complex life took all these extraordinary different forms that the ancestors of all the different kinds of animals we know today. And with robots, we seem to be seeing something similar. I'm not saying robots are alive, but we are seeing very rapidly, extraordinary rapid development in the deployment of various kinds of robotic machines. And, you know, it looks like we're only at the beginning of that, barring the collapse of civilization or whatever. But, you know, it looks like this is probably going to go on.
Well, that's, I guess, related to Ray Kurzweil's idea of the singularity. Is that sort of the Cambrian explosion?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, well, I mean, I've touched a bit on this in the last chapter, the final chapter of the book. I'm very sceptical about Ray Kurzweil. I think he profoundly misunderstands a lot of things. But yes, it's certainly in terms of the robots, they're taking increasing numbers of forms and capabilities, which most notably are likely to affect war fighting. Already we have predator drones are in some sense robots, but also things beyond them. And also economically, they're going to have a huge impact on what humans do, what activities we do, how we earn a living is going to be massive, obviously. And so this is part of the changing sense of ourselves and the changing sense of our relation to intelligent entities, we could call them in some sense, because they will have specific intelligences, perhaps not the kinds of general intelligence and emotional intelligence that you show so much of, but so, you know, this is going to be part of our future, perhaps.
Well, we have reached that final chapter. We've got to Zed, and the creature that you look at in the Zed chapter is the zebrafish. This nicely ties us up to the A chapter when we talked about the axolotl, because the zebrafish is another example of an unexpected creature to be found in a lab. So let's talk about why the zebrafish is being used in medical research.
Yeah. Well, there's, as you said, there's a few themes here, but the zebrafish is kind of minnow, not particularly amazing minnow-like fish from the Ganges, I think, originally. Very easy to breed and very, very widely used now in scientific research. One of the things that the chapter starts with is the just extraordinarily rapid rate at which the embryo forms, and it's a very beautiful thing to watch. I'd really recommend your listeners just look this up on the web if you like, look up the zebrafish embryo, and you can see this little fish forming in an astonishingly short amount of time. Obviously it's speeded up on the YouTube video, but it actually happens in about 48 hours. A whole creature is created in front of your eyes, and if you can, it's worth going to watch this happen as you can if you go to a lab. And they're used in all manner of medical research. One way in which they've recently come to been noticed in UK, I think last year, the British Heart Foundation talked about some of their work, which was using zebrafish, where they hope to really do some work on regeneration of heart tissue. And there's like numberless ways. They're one of the fundamental organisms used in scientific research, the guinea pig type organism. So that's one part of it. But then one of the things that people did with zebrafish in the last decade was to make them glow in different colours, and this fairly trivial, it seems, playful use of them, engineering a kind of new organism. And of course that issue starts to open onto a huge area of what people are doing in the manipulation of life, including perhaps potentially in synthetic biology, where perhaps some of the early claims have been really overstated, but nevertheless, given the rate of research and investment, we're going to see huge changes.
I'd like to talk about this really, and to conclude the interview, you actually have a very short chapter at the end of the book as a conclusion, which is called A Conclusion in Which Nothing Is Concluded. So I'd like to come back to the end of the zebrafish chapter and look at this, look at the idea of synthetic biology, and really, I guess, what you think are the possible futures for humanity. You talk about a little bit, and the possibility of attempts to create life through synthetic biology and things. So where do you think we're going, to finish off?
I don't know where we're going. My hope is that, among other things, we are going to pay as much attention to our moral and political development as our scientific development. And that's not easy. There's no guarantee, in my view, that things are going to get better and better. I mean, you can get people who spin you a very good story about rational optimism, and you can also get, in my view, people who spin you quite a convincing story about the total collapse of civilization as our kind of, of our impact on the environment overwhelms our future and we can't grow food and, the climate destabilizes. It's very hard to know where things are going to go. I think it's, in fact, necessarily hard, and because you've got complex adaptive systems with all kinds of variables, with unknown unknowns. With specific regard to synthetic biology, I wouldn't hazard any particular predictions, but I think we will see some astonishing things in the next few years, and one has to hope that many of them will be used in beneficial ways for human health and animal health, and maybe even for things like ecosystem restoration. Given human history, it wouldn't be surprising if there are already people looking at military applications, which could be pretty creepy. Even with the very relatively crude technology of the 1980s, the Soviets were starting to look at manipulation of pathogens for some really horrendous purposes. It wouldn't be at all surprising if people did that, but we have to hope that if it does happen, it'll be kept under control somehow. And so I think, like, nothing is concluded. I think we need to appreciate that we live in a world of astonishing wonders, but we can't know the future. And that actually isn't necessarily a disempowering message. It's something, because we don't know things are going to turn out good or bad, it's quite possible that we can actually have an impact, and that our behaviour is important. Our values and our sense of worth, informed by awareness of how the natural world is, can maybe help us to head off some of the worst possible scenarios.
I've been talking to Caspar Henderson about the book of Barely Imagined Beings, which is out now from Granta Books. So, Caspar, thanks for joining us on Little Atoms today.
Neil, thanks a lot. It's been great.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny. You can find the Little Atoms podcast and the Little Atoms Road Trip podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms. If you'd like to give a little bit of money to help support the show, please do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.